Welcome to Managing Safety, brought to you by the Florida Aviation Network, an effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and a coalition of local, regional, and national aviation organizations and agencies. This talk show addresses strategies for thinking in today's complex aviation world. Now, here's Diego Alfonso, airline transport pilot, designated pilot examiner with over 13,000 hours of dual given from Orlando, Florida, who is today's host.
My name is Diego Alfonso with the Florida Aviation Network, broadcasting live and in the clear from Sun and Fun at Lakeland, Florida. Today, we have with us Ernie Sanborn, who is the former director of the Florida Aviation Museum. And, of course, he has a tremendous repertoire of history about not only the aircrafts in the exhibits, but also the history of the museum. So, Ernie, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much, Diego.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the museum.
Well, the Florida Air Museum has a tremendous, huge exhibit here. We have over 8,500 pieces from Howard Hughes' personal collection. So that's of real historical interest to us and to a lot of people. If you remember, the Aviator movie that came out was about Howard Hughes. Well, Howard Hughes was also in the film business many, many years ago. He produced some 65 different films, not all on aviation.
Right.
But Hell's Angels was probably the best known of that group as far as aviation goes.
Right.
And we can talk a little bit more about that later if you like. But the museum itself, of course, has a lot of history in it. We start with the Benoit, actually, on our history wall. Thomas Benoit produced airplanes, and the first commercially scheduled airline was right here in Florida between St. Petersburg and Tampa. Back then, you could get a ride on that commercial airline for $5.
Right.
Well, it doesn't sound like much today, but back then,
a dollar a day
was a man's wage.
Yes.
So for $5, you know, you're spending a week's worth of wage. And that would be quite an imposition on a lot of the native people of that time. Native being native Floridians.
Yes. Which are, they're becoming an extinct species, I think.
Yes, I think the biggest population in Florida are import ships.
That's right.
And not native born.
Yeah.
But getting back to the Benoit, and it actually only lasted for 3 months. Started January 1st, so it was January, February, and March, and then it went out of business here in Florida.
Right.
They did move west of the Mississippi after that. But can you imagine the reason why business suddenly died here in Florida? Well, who could afford the ride?
That's right.
It'd be those people who are coming down as snowbirds. And when they went home in April, there wasn't any business left because the local people couldn't afford that type
exactly,
of money.
Exactly. It's an outrageous. Yeah. I mean, it's just a lot of money.
It was a lot of money. And the ex-mayor of St. Petersburg actually bid $400 for that first ride.
No kidding.
$400 to go fly from Tampa to St. Pete, yeah.
I knew about the airline and I knew the flights, but I never knew that particular piece of information
mm-hmm.
there. You know one thing that I really Howard Hughes is such a great individual when as far as aviation is concerned. The thing that really mesmerized me is I had the opportunity to go and see the Spruce Goose in
sure,
and I haven't been able to get in it or on it, but that's got to be a tremendous piece of equipment. Do you know anything related to that?
Oh, I know a lot of stories
okay.
about the Spruce Goose. First of all, it wasn't made out of spruce. It was made out of birch plywood.
Oh.
And he used a process called Duraform, which formed plywood under heat and pressure, and, of course, with glues. And that's how that structure was made. Very strong, very light for using a hardwood material.
Right.
Spruce Goose, of course, was kind of a nickname for it, I guess you might say. Its actual name was HK-1, and that was named after Henry Kaiser and Howard Hughes.
Okay.
And they were both involved in that project, though Kaiser later dropped out of that. And the whole idea about the airplane was you could load troops on it, 200 troops, a Sherman tank, and fly across the Atlantic to Europe, which at the time was...
Nonstop.
With the submarine fleet in the Atlantic that was picking off the troop transports.
Right.
That would increase the safety of getting troops across the Atlantic, you know, immeasurably. So that was the whole idea behind it. Unfortunately, the development of the airplane spanned the whole of World War II, so it never did get off the ground, so to speak. It did get off the water, though.
Yes.
It did get off the water. Flew one time with Howard Hughes at the controls, and he'd made several taxi tests across the bay, and he was going to make one last test, but decided to let the press and the media off before he made that test and said, we're all done testing for today. You know, we're going back out, but we're not going to do anything really spectacular. The only media that was left on there was actually a live radio broadcast. And because of the equipment that he had on the airplane, he couldn't get off.
Right.
So he got to go on that first flight. Hughes had made, as I said before, taxi tests up to 92 miles an hour across the water. Well, that last test, he called for partial flaps. And when he did get partial flaps, the airplane flew.
That's right.
At about 74 miles an hour. Now, did he intend to fly? According to his co-pilot, a gentleman by the name of Grant, and Grant, by the way, was a hydraulics engineer. He was not a pilot.
Okay.
He was a hydraulics engineer, and Hughes had him on the airplane because this was the first hydraulically controlled flying surfaces. You see, the flying surfaces were so huge that a man couldn't lift them, and if you could lift them, you'd stretch the cables.
Right.
So it had to be something a little more positive than that. So they did use hydraulics. And according to Grant, when Hughes called for flaps, the airplane flew, and first thing Hughes did was pull back on the power, because it surprised him. He didn't expect it to lift off, again, according to Grant. So he had pulled back the power, and then Grant's over there hollering at him, more power, more power, more power, because without the power, they didn't have any hydraulic control.
Oh, I see.
So he would have lost control of the airplane. So Hughes gave it partial
power. So the flaps retract, or?
No, the flaps would have stayed, but he had lost hydraulic power to the elevator and the ailerons.
I see, okay.
So anyway, more power. And Hughes turned to Grant and said, it just ballooned on me. He didn't expect it to fly.
Right.
Though you'll read a lot of different accounts on that, but coming from the gentleman that was sitting in the right seat of that airplane, I kind of think that's probably a correct
story. I heard, and of course, this is just rumors, and you probably heard this too, that there was kind of a litigation going on as far as getting paid for whatever... Because I think it was a bid with the government that's what I'm saying. This are rumors, and that he somehow they wanted to get away without paying, and because they say that the airplane would never fly, some people say that the reason why he just did that was to prove that the airplane fly. So I don't know if there's any value to that, but anyway, that's a rumor out there.
I like you bringing up the part about Hughes not paying or not getting paid. I don't recall ever when Hughes didn't get paid. I can recall many stories when Hughes didn't pay.
Didn't pay. Okay. All right.
Howard Hughes didn't carry any money in his pocket. And he really was a person that talked with the average man more than he talked with his administrators that he had in his company. He never came into Hughes Aircraft during the daytime. I won't say never, but very rarely would he do that. He'd come in at night. He'd go through all the engineering drawings, make notes on them, and leave them for the engineers to come in the next day to discover and make the changes that Hughes had indicated on the drawings.
Right.
So, and if you look back at the drawings of that age, and we got about 6,500 different drawings, If you look back at those drawings, these are works of art. They're all hand-done, of course, engineering graphics, three-dimensional, shaded. They're just beautiful works in almost perfect condition from being 80 years old. And that's the way Hughes operated. But as I said, he didn't have any, didn't carry any money. So when he wanted money, he'd walk up to a line boy and ask him money for a cup of coffee or whatever it was he wanted.
Right, right, right.
And of course, everything was bills, so he never carried cash on him.
Sure, and everybody knew him, you know.
Oh,
most of everybody knew him. But it's interesting that you say that because I took drafting early on in my high school days. That's before the computers and everything.
Sure.
And I remember that everything, you had to use a ruler, T, then you use whatever other gadgets you had to draw everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now you just sit in front of a computer and you want a graph, the graph is done. You want this, it's done.
Right.
And so when you say that, I'd seen those graphics from before, and that, just like you say, it's work of art. I mean, everything is so neat and so precisely so.
And I like the drawings because they're all smudge-free. Now, I did engineering graphics too, and mine weren't smudge-free.
Now, so what are the plans for the museum in the near future with Sun and Fun?
In the near future, as you know, aviation is really a specialized group of people.
Right.
Well, they're a special group of people,
right.
Let's face it,
right.
Because you and I are both pilots, right? We know we're special. But only about 10% of the public is really interested in aviation now. So we want to appeal to more people than that. We have some great history here in the museum. We start out, of course, I mentioned the Benoit, 1914, the Baby Lakes was built when Matty Laird was a teenager, and then he taught himself how to fly it.
Right.
But we go through the whole history of airplanes here in the museum, and boy, it's a great history. We have, for example, the vertical riser, which was a piston-driven airplane that was supposed to take off and land vertically. Control issues were an issue, and that didn't work out. We also have the C-Dot, which was the only seaplane ever to break the sound barrier. However, it was kind of ill-conceived as well because it was supposed to be dropped off a ship, on an escort ship,
right,
and provide fleet defense. You know, you drop it off, put a pilot in the seat, and he can go defend the whole fleet. Well, what they forgot is there are waves out there in the ocean.
That's right.
And trying to land in anything over a 4-foot wave would have been suicide. So, you know, you'd have lost the airplane.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's here. We also have an F-14D, which is the latest aircraft in our arsenal. But from those ranges, we've got quite a selection of aircraft, home built, factory built. It does span the whole of aviation.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interesting items, you know, like if you take a look at this engine over here, I was just reading about it. You know, it's like, what, 20, 30 horsepower, and there's another one over there that costs like $250 new, and they're making the advertising saying we increase the power and the size, but not the price. You know, $250 for a three-cylinder or a two-cylinder engine.
Right.
It's a lot of history. It's a lot of things that if you're an aviation enthusiast, I mean, this is the place to go if you're in Florida.
Right.
If you're in Florida.
Well, what we're trying to do, of course, is appeal to a greater audience by becoming more interactive. So we're trying to attract the youth.
Right.
And we do that a lot through our education programs here. We have our STEMtastics programs, which concentrate on STEM science, STEM programs, science, technology, engineering, and math.
Right.
So-called STEM sciences,
STEM. Yeah. I learned that term just a little while ago.
Oh, really?
Because I had Lori
Bradnam
here, and she brought it up. I didn't know it existed, but it's very interesting. Go ahead.
And the other thing we do is we teach kids how to fly. Starting at age 11, we have a Destination Aviation summer camps, and kids come down here, and I think we teach them right. I remember my first experience in an airplane. I was probably 30 years old, never sat in the left seat of an airplane before, never been in an airplane right. before, let's face it, at least a small one.
Right.
And after that ride, which was my first lesson, I didn't know if I was going to come back again. I was nervous. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know anything about the panel or how the engine operated. But I made up my mind, I'm not a quitter, so I'm going to go back and try it at least one more time. And if I don't like it that second time, I'm not coming back. But obviously, I developed a passion. But
I totally agree with you. As a matter of fact, I had a school at one point. Own a school in Orlando, and when we did the discovery, the so-called discovery flights,
right.
I took very, very, very good care of how that was going to be done, and because precisely that, what happens is sometimes people are going to learn how to fly, and they go for the first flight, and they put them in the airplane, and you go. And I don't think that's right. The person should be totally briefed, not only in the equipment, but also in the charts. In other words, this is Lakeland, and we're going to be taking off to the east. You see, and where do you live in relation to the airport? And the guy will say, well, I live to the south. Well, when we're taking off, your house is going to be on your right. In other words, to give the person an idea
right.
of what, because once you are airborne, it's like you're lost.
Oh, sure. You don't know what's going on.
And it's like you're not moving.
You miss so much. Well, what we do is we prepare the kids 3 days before they ever get in an airplane. They do a pre-flight as one of the things, but we also do weather with them. They plan their own cross-country flight. They know through some simulators are a blessing. They do really help.
Right.
They know how the instruments work. They know about the throttle and leaning back and trim and all these technical things that when I first got in the airplane, I didn't have any idea. So after 3 days, we've got kids that are taxiing the airplane out, taking off from the runway, climbing to altitude, turning to the cross-country heading, flying to the next airport, and landing the airplane with the instructor often just sitting there with his hands in his lap.
Right.
Or I shouldn't say he, because we have some excellent female instructors as well.
Yeah, right. Well, I do a lot of safety seminars, and the formula for aviation, and I'm coining this, it's 85% knowing and 15% doing.
Sure.
What happens, though, is reversed. What you have now is you have pilots doing 85% and knowing 15%, because nobody likes to read. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes to study. We like to fly. I don't want to pay an instructor just to talk to him. I want to fly, you know, that type of thing.
Sure.
So I really believe that knowledge. And also, way back, I did a check ride for a lady doctor. And during the very nice lady, I found out she was also a professor in a medicine college and medical school. And she said something to me that stayed with me the whole time. And this has been probably 18 years ago. She said, "The eye can't see what the mind doesn't know."
I understand what you're saying.
And you can take that to the bank.
Yeah.
That's why in my seminars, I say to the instructor, when I do seminars for instructors, I always tell them, if you show me a pilot that has a problem answering a correlative question or has a problem performing a procedural maneuver, I'm going to show you a pilot that doesn't understand what he or she is trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the basics of the whole thing. And that phase of 3 days prepares this individual for that.
Exactly.
And it's enjoyable.
Yes. They're ready to learn.
Exactly.
And that first ride I had, I wasn't ready to learn. I was too emotional about the whole experience.
Exactly. Same here. Yeah. I was like, you know, what happened here? Why we stopped? Because that first flight is scary.
It is.
And then what happens is, some of us, the bug is so strong and so big that we make it back to the airport. But a lot of them, they buy a boat.
Yep.
and you never seen him again around the airport. Right. And I think that's a very interesting point, and it's something that needs to be worked on. I was looking at that Red Baron there. What's the history behind that?
Well, first of all, you're not looking at an airplane.
Okay.
You're looking at a collection of airplane parts. Red Baron Pizza, of course, had the Red Baron squadrons, one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast, that they used to do air shows with, and it was very expensive. So they decided not to do that anymore. But to advertise Red Baron Pizza, they had that on top of a building down in Tampa. So what I've been told, anyway.
Right.
And that was just a display. Control surfaces were all fixed because, obviously, if you have it in the wind, movable control surface would wear them out, wear the fabric out, etc. So they just built a display from a collection of parts that they had, and that whole thing will come apart in about 15 minutes, and you can put it back together in 30. So if we wanted to move it, drop it on the floor, tear it apart.
But it doesn't look like, when you look at it from from the bottom up, it looks like the whole thing is pretty well put together.
It is. It is. They did an amazing job on that. But let's just say that none of those parts up there ever flew together collectively.
They just found their home right here.
That's right.
That's what they did. And how about this one over here?
We're talking about, Steve Whitman's racer. Yeah. Obviously, Steve Whitman did donate that to the museum, and we do have an exhibit here on racing. And this afternoon, by the way, we expect to have the old P-51 racer, Howie Keefe, here.
Okay.
And he's going to be 92 here in just a few short weeks. So if anybody's really interested in air racing, he's the guy to talk with. But Steve Whitman, of course, was very active in the early days of air racing.
Now, that airplane, is an American-made airplane, or is that an English-made airplane?
No, that's all a hands-built airplane that Steve Whitman built himself and developed. Yeah,
because I've seen I believe it's got the engine upside down.
That's correct, inverted engine.
Right, inverted engine,
and just to make it clear to people, when they think of an engine upside down, they're probably thinking of an automobile engine where the crankshaft is on the bottom.
Right.
Well, if you invert the engine and you have the crankshaft on the top, then you have more propeller clearance.
Yeah. Yep. Right there is the
airplane. Yes. Yep.
So say that last statement again, because that was interesting. You said that by inverting the engine
so the crankshaft is on the top and they bolted the propeller to the crankshaft, then you have more ground clearance. When you look at that airplane compared to a lot of different racers, it's got a very short landing gear. Less landing gear, less weight, faster
less
you're going to go.
Less drag.
Less drag, sure.
That's interesting. I really didn't notice that. That's right, because if you turn that thing the other way, that propeller is going to be down another couple, the axis of the propeller will be down probably a couple feet.
Yes.
Easily. Easily.
So you'd have to have a landing gear that was 2 feet taller.
Right. That reminds me of some of the English airplanes,
Oh, really?
That have the
Monasco engines and
the engines inverted.
Yeah.
Well, Ernie, let me ask you one more question. This here, it looks like a chair. And I was reading before, and it said that the wings were too large to be able to be displayed here. I imagine that's a home built.
That is an ultralight airplane, yes. And it came to us, the donor was hoping that we'd fly it. When we looked at the airframe, there were a lot of cracks in the aluminum, and it didn't look like it was going to be very safe. Our high school on campus, which is the Central Florida Aerospace Academy, we have a restoration club, and those kids come over and they restored that airframe, took it all apart, cleaned it, repainted it, put it all back together. So it made an attractive exhibit. Yes, we do have the wings. The wings have been repaired and they're ready for paint now. But they're 40 some odd feet long,
Yes, yes.
And with an airplane that sits so low to the ground, We just don't have room to walk around 40 feet of wing in this museum.
Exactly. And I was looking, well, first when I saw it, I thought that there was, I'd seen some of those contraptions that have like a parachute, you know, in the back.
Yes.
And then you get
like
going.
Like a trike.
A trike. But then when I read the caption, it kind of, you could see that it is not. It's just an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
But the wings are missing. I mean, that's the whole thing there.
Yeah.
Now we have that over there, that looks like the one that have the front and tandem, you know, front and back.
Oh yes, that's the spacewalker. That was built by a gentleman by the name of Conrad Miller. He's a master builder, and he is 86 now, and he just donated another airplane to the museum besides the spacewalker. So equal, perfect construction on that airplane, and that's an Alpha HB-207. It's the only one flying in the country. It's a German design, and you'll see it outside the museum. It has a five-bladed prop, so it's very noticeable.
Yes, yes.
And beauty about that airplane, we were just talking about one that got 54 miles to the gallon, I believe, on fuel, set a record. This airplane also cruises at 154 miles an hour on 3.5 gallons per hour.
God.
Very fuel efficient, you know, up in the 40 miles per gallon range.
Yeah, I think I saw a sign somewhere that it holds the record for...
That it does, for fuel efficiency.
For fuel efficiency, like 75 yep. Miles per gallon. I wish my car would do that.
Yeah, me too.
I wonder if I should drive to work in that thing.
You could probably fly to work in it, but I'm not sure you could drive.
Well, Ernie, unfortunately, we have reached that point in the segment where we're going to have to say goodbye to you. I mean, I really enjoy the conversation. I enjoy the history. I enjoy all the facts and figures that you have given us. And I really think that now I'm a little bit more knowledgeable about aviation, and not only aviation, but the artifacts and airplanes that are here at the Air Museum. And for that, me and our audience will thank you so much for taking your time and stepping here.
Real pleasure.
We hope you've enjoyed today's Managing Safety, brought to you by the Florida Aviation Network, an effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and a coalition of local, regional, and national aviation organizations and agencies. Please visit our studio website to hear past programs.